saying, you know,
yeah.
This is a different shade of gray. We've done something.
Yeah. All right.
On that last point, I think in line with the policy that you were discussing back there, perhaps the statutory award of attorney's fees to the owner on disallowance of the lien should override a contractual provision, because the whole idea was don't file your lien and take it to court if it's an invalid lien. So I guess there really isn't a problem that this probably the statutory provision would override the contractual provision for attorney's fees, and probably should on that rationale that if you've got an invalid lien, drop it.
Dismiss it and proceed on your contract where you're aware of attorney's fees. So you'd be a better case. You shouldn't bring a lien in. I think we're okay.
All right.
With the discussion of the bill as amended, do you have a motion now on the bill?
I don't remember.
Mr. Smith moves House Bill 2645 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Barrett?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Good.
Chair?
Aye.
Now, while we have the two of you here, we have late two other bills we'd like to ask you. Would you please pull those files out later?
Yes.
We have a couple of extra chairs if you'd like to sit.
Much prefer sitting down here responding, thank you.
Okay, back to the omnibus bill. Judge Hargraves?
The question that I had raised before the adjournment was on page 10 of line 12, where I was talking about the question of determining how many crimes you have committed in terms of one violation of one statute against one victim but repeated offenses. In the language, it talks about affording a defendant an opportunity to renounce the criminal intent. I understand Mr. Gary has some language that he proposed to change that somewhat, but it produces the same problem. That is, right now, when we're talking about merger and we're talking about how many times a person can be convicted and sentenced for a series of offenses happening sort of all together, right now that's a legal decision that we make at the time of sentencing. What I see in this is the probability that this may shift to a factual determination for the jury, and if it doesn't shift to become a factual consideration for the jury, whether we're going to have some legal problems with that. I assume that the state's going to continue to do what they've always done. They're going to charge the defendant with three rapes or whatever the case may be, and then when we get all done with the case and the jury comes back and says, okay, fine, we find that he did it two or three times over a period of whatever, then the question becomes, all right, do I determine whether there was a period of time in between where he could have renounced one or more of these, and therefore I sentence him on one or two or three? Or does that become now a question for the jury to determine whether, as a element of these offenses, whether he is guilty of those or not? Because if you're saying you get into some definitional problems, I guess, is the question here. Are we really saying what we have is you can get three jury verdicts on this, and then, judge, you have to, as a legal decision, decide whether you can sentence on all of these based on this standard that's set forth here, or have you got three cases that go to the jury where you tell the jury, if you decide he did the first act, then if you find that he has had time to renounce and didn't, then determine whether he did the second act and on down the line. I think that's very unclear, and I really don't know how, and I have any suggestions for you, except that I see that as a problem that needs to be looked at and, if possible, clarified here so that we know who's going to be making this determination. And I think the standard by which we're asking that to be made should be fairly vague also. So I don't offer any real suggestions, unfortunately, for you, but just to point that out as a problem area that I see.
I think, I assume Mr. Gary and others who are concerned that issue make a note of these comments.
Okay.
Another area that I'd like to turn to is in section 16 on page 11. That's starting on, on line 9, we're talking about what is essentially currently the state of the law there in section 1, that is the judges are, and currently says judges and district attorneys and sheriffs or arresting agencies are supposed to supply a certain information to the parole board. Now there's a recent Oregon, this is a Supreme Court case, that has said that, is my understanding, that has said that the parole board can't set their parole times and whatnot without that information. And that's fine, except that we in Lane County, and I assume judges around the state, back, well, it must have been, come on, 78, somewhere in there, a large number of us anyway, quit sending that information in because the parole board, first of all, quit sending us the forms, and we were told that they didn't care to have us send that material anymore. So for years, most of us have not been sending that material, and the system's been operating apparently reasonably well without it. Now that issue was raised on appeal, and the Supreme Court said, no, parole board, you have to get that information. Court of Appeals, Smith versus Oregon Board of Parole, came out April 13, 1983. And
which information, though, are you talking about, Jeff?
I'm talking about the information that came in what we used to call the after sentence report that we sent to the parole board, which is what I and what the Court of Appeals cites as being the information that's being sought by your Section 16 here. And that was always the question. They had a form that they sent out that asked you all the information, certain information about the defendant, all of which was usually contained in the pre-sentence report. Then it asked you to tell them how long you thought the person ought to serve, which always seemed to be a bit strange when they were setting the matrix and didn't take into account the sentence we gave the person anyway. And what we're doing is perpetuating that language here, and I've never known how to adequately comply with it if I was going to. The parole board gets a copy of the pre-sentence report. I don't know whether it's contemplated that they want us to send them a transcript of the trial, because it says something about all the facts. Let's see here. Yes, a statement of all the facts concerning such convicted person's crime and any other information which the court may have concerning the convicted person. Now, in most cases, of course, what we have is a pre-sentence report, and we may have some letters from friends of the defendant saying what a swell person he or she is, and a petition for probation from the defendant's lawyer telling you what a swell person this person is, and that's generally the facts that we have about the case. Now, the only time that that's different, of course, is when we try the case, and we obviously may have some additional information from that. But I don't see that we're accomplishing much of anything with this particular language, and keeping it in seems to make little sense, particularly when you get down to the part that still says that we may indicate to the board in our judgment what the duration of the convicted person's confinement ought to be. I mean, that's why we're struggling here mightily with pages of material about sentences. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what's supposed to be served by that.
Well, actually, I think our intention there, we borrowed this provision from a portion of a Senate bill which was intended to reverse that Court of Appeals decision so far as it was based on the absence of information obtained from the district attorney, the sheriff, and the arresting agency. I think our intention was otherwise, not to make any, so far as this provision goes, make a change in present law.
Well, I understand that. I guess what I'm saying is that I think you ought to make that change, because I don't see that. First of all, I don't know how to comply with it, and second of all, I don't know that the parole board's getting anything if I do.
Well, perhaps what we should do a little bit later when we get to the parole board is talk a bit more about what specific information we in fact want to mandate be provided to the board from the judge. Perhaps be more specific about it.
The other, another problem, just logistically, if you decide to leave that in, what has happened in the past, and when we were getting these mailings from the parole board, they weren't coming, of course, until the person was in the penitentiary, and I don't know, maybe even sometime close to when they were going to do a set on him or something like that. So we get a form saying, tell us everything you know about John Doe. And by that time, obviously, I know almost nothing about John Doe, so I go back and I have to call the file up from back downstairs and get the pre-sentence report out, and then I reread the pre-sentence report and I reread the file. Then I try to reconstruct in my mind why I did what I did on the day that I did it, so I don't have to call up the court reporter and have her read back to me the proceedings so I can remember that. It's an awkward process if that's the time frame in which we're going to do it. That's something else you may look at.
Okay.
Oh, yes. In subparagraph 2 on that same page, page 11, we talk about, again, giving the parole board transcripts of...
I'm sorry, we're under call.
Call.
Call. See you in a moment.
Never here, I'm really almost done. I was talking about on page 11 at line 20 where they talk about transcripts of reasons and findings on certain sentences. It goes back again to some of my basic concerns about who should be doing what. But also there, I think you ought to be looking at the question of who's going to be paying for those transcripts, how many we may be looking at. Court reporters don't work for free when they make transcripts, and every one of those transcripts is going to cost somebody some money, whether that's going to come out of my budget or whether it's going to come out of somebody else's budget, I don't know, but it seems to me that that's certainly one of the concerns that we ought to address here. I think I've said enough about my philosophy about who ought to be providing information to the parole board in what forms, but I think you ought to look at the dollar cost, because I haven't really got a feel for how many you're really looking at. If you look at the statistics that Judge Bonebrake had on how many minimum sentences, for instance, were being given out, there's a whole pile. And I don't have any idea what that may be in terms of dollars or how you can support that. Kind of to, I guess, to finish off with that and a final comment that goes back to these questions of the various findings and reasons and that sort of thing and putting those into various orders. We talked about this earlier on when 2087 first came out. And we talked about it in terms of the time impacts on the court, how many hearings we are going to have and how long those may take us. If it's contemplated that we're going to be making more and more of these findings to produce a sentence, then I am sure that we're going to have longer and longer sentencing proceedings as it becomes our lot to litigate the various findings that we have to make that are consonant with the information the parole board wants. I can see us quite easily litigating the issue of how long the person's been since their last conviction, how old they were at their last conviction, how many convictions are really good and how many are bad. We're going to go back and litigate within the sentencing proceeding whether or not this conviction back in 1953 was an uncounseled conviction, therefore you can't use that in the matrix to set my or make your findings about how bad or how good I've been. It seems to me there's just a whole myriad of those things that are open for litigation, and I don't know about other counties because I don't sit around the state very often, but I know in Lane County we litigate everything in the world there is to litigate down there, and I'm quite sure that we'll be litigating those issues just ad nauseum. And that's another concern that I have is the more you tell us we have to find, the more time we're going to have to spend to do it. And quite frankly, the fewer cases we're going to try and the fewer sentences we're going to get imposed. And I have a real concern about that.
I requested back on the floor for a procedural issue.
I'm wrangling
about something when we left. I was afraid of that. Judge, do you have any more you want to add
on
your testimony?
That covers
like
things that I want to say.
Without interrupting you again, if we can. Okay, we're going to go back down, and then if the two of you could wait a moment,
sure.
I think there will be a question or two.
No problem.
Apologies to all of you. Thank you for your patience.
That stage of the session, I'm praying with.
Some, I think individuals are curious what my intentions are about proceeding with the testimony. I would like to try to proceed as far as we can today without running unduly late. I might, in a moment after we finish questioning the judges, inquire who here, particularly from out of town, would find it inconvenient to return to a second hearing. Let me take those folks. That is not to diminish the importance of the time. Administrators like Mr. Watson, those in the Corrections Division and elsewhere, but particularly those out of town, however, I think the problem is even more severe. So we'll do that in a moment. Representative Lombard, I think you had a question.
Well, yeah, I wanted to address this to Judge Hargreaves, and I guess it's this, that I can't even remember how long ago it was when we first addressed this and put our instructions to the committee to come back with the omnibus, but with regards to the findings, the testimony we were getting from the parole board, and maybe this just gets to the root of the problem of the concern of the judges that they don't listen to us anyway, but at least in particular in those cases where the judges had imposed mandatory minimum sentences, in those cases where the judges accompanied their sentencing order with an explanation of why they did what they did, we were given examples of certain judges did that. In most of those cases, the mandatory minimums were upheld. But my recollection of the testimony was that, by and large, in most cases where a mandatory minimum was set, no additional reasons were given. Nothing was said with regards to exacerbating circumstances or what have you. And the parole board really had nothing to go on. And those were the ones that were most often overthrown on the 4 or 5 vote margin. I guess our concern was, at least under the current system, that if we required these findings, I think in my own mind, particularly in those cases where mandatory minimums are imposed, that way the parole board will have some idea of what's going on in the mind of the judge at the time of sentencing, is more likely to go along with what the judge did. And my answer might go a long ways in answering the concerns of the judiciary that, hell, they don't listen to us anyway. Now, maybe we've gone too far in this draft by, if I read it correctly, calling for the issuance of findings in every single case. I tend to agree with you. I suspect there's an awful lot of pedestrian cases in which all you do is look at the PSI and repeat the same thing. But it does seem to me that on page 11, in any event, we are picking out some specific kinds of cases which I would suspect that if you gave the reasons for your ruling, for your finding, you might find a lot more of those upheld.
Well, I guess the problem that I have, and I continue to have, and it's to a large extent a philosophical problem, is that what I see happening here is what I see as the sort of the tail wagging the dog. And that is, I'm given a job to do, that is, I adjudicate. And if we go forward, at least with part of this bill, I will make the in or out decision. If I'm going to be left also with some idea of setting some sort of mandatory minimum based upon my perception of the case, then that's fine too. But my role ends there. And what the people on the parole board do is a whole different role, maybe done for a whole different reason, and maybe done on different considerations and even maybe different information than I have. And it, to me, what I continue to be very concerned about is what I see is the slippage or the blurring of these lines between what the court ought to be doing. And the philosophy that I see expressed here is we want somebody else to decide how long that person stays in prison. If that's what you want, if you don't want the court to do that, then keep us out of that. Don't make us make the findings for the parole board. They may set whatever criteria they want, but there's absolutely no reason that we should be making the findings based upon whatever it is they decide that they want to use to make that decision. I'm making my decision based upon what I have before me for whatever reasons may come along in that case. They, in turn, ought to make their decision based upon the information that they have and the reasons that they want to do that with the information that they have before them at the time they consider it for whatever reasons they think are appropriate. And to say that the parole board over here is going to control the judge's job over here, I think is wrong, and I think I have a very strong philosophical disagreement with that.
I guess my point in part, though, at least again on these mandatory minimums, is that we have said as a matter of policy that we are going to give you judges some additional authority to fit the particular circumstances of a given case, because we do feel that you're much closer to it at the time. And if you have some particular feelings about a case, and you think, and you're, for whatever reasons, policy, philosophical, or whatever your perceptions are, you think that that individual ought to be incarcerated for a minimum mandatory time, we're saying as a matter of policy, or we have said as a matter of policy, that you have a right to make that determination, to give it your subjective judgment, if that's what you want to call it. But we're also saying, by tightening up on the parole board's ability to overturn that, that there's got to be maybe some pretty good reasons for the parole board overturning that. I guess from our perspective, at least from mine, historically, I would like to see most of your mandatory minimums upheld. But if you don't give reasons or give the parole board the benefit of those extra perceptions that you have, I don't know how they can be expected to uphold that.
Well, they can uphold it in the same way that they do now. They take what information they have, they review the case, and they figure out what they think the case is worth. That's what we're doing, and that's what they're doing. And
you don't think you have an extra benefit, advantage, or something there that they don't have? Whether it's watching the demeanor of the individual on the stand,
I think that's undoubtedly true. But at the same time, I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it.
Do you want the authority to?
If I
let me
put okay, let me put it this way. For me personally, if I have to play what I see as this game, then no. Just let me make the in or out decision. Get me out of it. That's my preference. If you want me to do this sort of thing for the parole board, then philosophically, no. Just get me out of it. I'll put them in. We can let them out. That's the way I really, that's my baseline feeling, is that they're making their own decisions for whatever reasons they're making them. And those may not be the same reasons that I'm operating on down here, and there's nothing to say that whatever my reasons are, that those will have any relationship to what they perceive to be reality at the time that they review that. And I think, frankly, it's just got to be sort of a silly game from my point of view. If we're going to say I'm not going to set the top end either, if I'm just going to commit them to the corrections division, then I just should be out of it.
The thing that troubles me, though, Judge, is that it seems to me that the factual basis
while both parole board and judicial decisions dealing with period, affecting period of confinement, it's forgetting it out for me, ought to be the same. We ought to be working with the same standards.
But they never will be if you have two different groups of people making two different decisions. See, I make a decision, and I make a sentencing decision based upon a number of things that I think ought to occur, of course. Then the parole board comes along, and they're going to be reviewing that, and the standards that they use to review is my first concern, is you're telling me I have to conduct my performance with some standards that they're going to set before I, that means anything to me, and I don't think that they ought to have control the judicial branch in that fashion. And secondly, the way that we look at those cases may be considerably different for different reasons. And we're accomplishing different things. And what I may have as reasons to do what I did that time may bear no real resemblance to the reason they're going to do what they're going to do at a later time. And I don't know what more to say about it.
Well, my only point is that if the, regardless of how given individuals would react to those reasons, I don't think that the period of confinement of individuals ought to be rest on different reasons as in terms of controlling the decisions of a trial judge versus different from those which would affect the decisions of a board.
But they,
in either, I'm only talking about the underlying criteria which would determine the period of confinement. I'm not necessarily saying the reaction to those would be the same.
But
right
it seems to me that that necessarily occurs right now and has been occurring all along, because what you have is me sitting down there saying, I think this is worth X amount of time, knowing full well it doesn't mean anything, but I say it. And I'm not taking into account when I say that how many Class C felons I may have to release tomorrow because Judge Burns says or things like that. I'm taking into account what I think that crime is worth. And then when we get over to the parole board, they're going to make their own decision, four of them or five of them or however many, and I don't know what reasons they're going to use to override my decision. Suppose I make all the findings in the world and they disagree when we haven't accomplished anything.
First of all, I'm not talking about their utilizing or your utilizing prison overcrowding as a factor in the decision of how long to imprison someone. Let's assume that isn't a factor for a minute. It does seem to me that the reasons that go into setting the period of confinement, or the factors that go into that, whether they be those weighed by a judge or those weighed by a parole board, ought to be the same.
Well, I guess the only thing that I can say is that I don't think that I necessarily agree with you, because I think that the parole board is looking at it from a whole different perspective than the trial judge is. The trial judge is looking at it on the front end, that is, am I going to send the person to jail? What did they do? How bad are they? This sort of thing. The parole board is really starting to look at it on the back end. How soon am I going to let them out? How good are they? What's their circumstance? All these sorts of things. I don't think that the criteria need to be the same at all. And in many cases would not be.
Just a quick question. Setting aside this parole board discussion, do you think that a system of justice where a judge is allowed a certain amount of discretion in sentencing people, that that judge should state for the record why he or she is sentencing defendant A for crime X to such a sentence and defendant B the same crime, sentence them to a different sentence? Do you think there should be some statement on the record as to why the judge is doing what he or she is doing?
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that.
Okay, so why? And I think the other thing is from a public perception standpoint, since we do get a discussion, as we do, I realize there's boundaries, Your Honor, but why, and I thought maybe I'm getting off here, I thought that that was also a reason that we got into this discussion in terms of some kind of statement. Certain judges, we understood, we had one statement, some judges, incredible prose he uses. I won't name the judge where he's from, incredible prose. And maybe it's the prose that has the parole board mesmerized because they've never touched anything he's done. But aside from what the parole board does or doesn't do, Judge Hargreaves, the fact that some judges are apparently coming up with pros or a detailed statement, and others apparently aren't doing anything. I'm not saying, I don't know that, Your Honor. Should we do something about that? Parole board aside, get them out.
Parole board aside, no. Doesn't concern me.
So you don't think you should, if you sentence somebody, you don't think you should make any statement on the record as to why you're sentencing this person to the joint for so many years, as opposed to someone else who's convicted of the same crime, and you're not sentencing them to the joint?
Well, let me put it this way. If you, in fact, say, put the parole board aside, then I think the simple answer to your question is that's right. What purpose are you serving if you want us to make some sort of statement or finding? The only purpose that I can think of then is you're telling the defendant, well, I think you're going to pen for 5 years because this, that, and the other. That may be nice and may be informational for the defendant, but what have you accomplished? Anything? I don't think so.
But if the defendant is requesting the board to set aside the minimum.
Now, wait a minute. We're setting aside the parole board here. You can change the facts on me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I understand. I'm moving over to the direction.
Excuse me. Okay.
Assistant. I mean, I understand what your concern is.
Are publicly elected to state of Oregon.
Right.
We do allow them a certain amount of discretion. You may even want more than you have or less.
Sure.
You look to your wisdom, whatever in terms of what you're going to do. From the public.